Welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. The war rages on the land they call somewhere, and generals order their men to kill and to fight for a cause that they've long ago forgotten, while the little cloud weeps on the side of a hill. On the Side of a Hill by Paul Simon. The wolf and the lamb will feed together, and the lion will eat straw like an ox, and dust will be the serpent's food. They will neither harm nor destroy on all of my holy hill. Thus says the Lord. Isaiah 65:25. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Speaking with Joy. This week's episode is going to be looking at the song Scarborough Fair by Simon and Garfunkel and themes of violence and peace. This is an episode that I have been so excited to share with you all, and I've kind of been putting it off because I keep on thinking over it and trying to perfect it, and I'm sure that even this won't perfectly capture all my thoughts on it. But it's something I love both because I think it's such a compelling theme, but also because I absolutely love 60s and 70s music. There's something about it that I've always loved, the sound and the themes and the way that the songs are so kind of intimately written with a kind of songwriting we don't really hear much in the radio anymore. So all this to say, since I have been compiling the notes for the show, I have also been compiling a playlist. So I have a Spotify playlist for you all, which I will attach in the show notes on joyclarkson.com. So please make sure to go and follow that and enjoy all the songs on it. Also, I will say it is best listened to if you put it on shuffle. And I'm also too excited to share with you all that my brother Joel and I have recorded a new song, which I will include a little clip of at the end of this podcast. And we are kind of working on a new album. We've done two other EPs before. Honest Songs is one of them, and the other is Son of Man. So if you want to look that up, we're at Two Benedictions. And we've been really enjoying kind of writing some new music together. And in some ways, I feel like it's the best stuff we've ever done. So in the theme of looking at songwriters today from the 60s and 70s, please check out our new song, which we have on our Patreon. And if you donate a small amount, really whatever is fine, then you will get the download of kind of the unproduced version. And also some videos of us preparing the song and kind of what it looks like for us to write a song together, which is really a wonderful thing. So listen in for those two things at the end of this podcast. Go find the playlist on Spotify. And also, if you feel like it, go donate to our Patreon to help us kind of get this album going and to also get a download of the new song along with some fun videos of our performances. So without further ado, let's dive into this week's topic. So to get a beginning on talking about Simon Garfunkel and why I love this era of music so much, when I think of it, I think of Simon and Garfunkel and James Taylor and Joni Mitchell and Jim Croce and, oh my goodness, there's so many that I just love. Kind of to give you a fun background of part of what sowed this love in my heart is that when I was younger, when I learned to drive, I don't know if this is how it is everywhere, but in Colorado, you have to have 60 hours of driving time before you can get your license. And so I was the youngest of four children and we were always busy. So sometimes it was hard to get those in because, you know, you just always had older siblings who wanted to drive you. So my mom would take me out by myself and we would drive all around the country roads near where we lived and we would listen to albums, particularly of James Taylor, but also she also loved Simon and Garfunkel and several others. And we would just drive around and we'd talk about teenager things because I was 16 at that point, and we would listen to these songs. So there's this kind of treasure in my heart of this love of the music that passed down from the songs and the writers that my mother and father loved, and kind of this association with good memories. But there's also something that I always seem to connect with in the music from the 60s and 70s. And I think that I've come to realize that it was because they were asking questions that I'm asking now. And to do that, we have to kind of look back to this ephemeral period of the 60s. We hear people talk about this a lot. Also, I should pause to note that you might be able to hear birds outside my window. And they are so loud, but also so lovely. So if you hear noises, that's what that is. So the 60s. People talk about the 60s. There were these strange, a lot of times we associate it with, you know, kind of rock and roll and drugs and all these things. And that's not untrue. But really, the 60s were a really complex time where a lot was happening. Our good friend Wikipedia says this. The term the 1960s, also referred to more commonly as 60s, is denoting a complex of interrelated cultural and political trends around the globe. This, quote, cultural decade is more loosely defined than the actual decade itself. It begins around 1963 with the Kennedy assassination and ends around 1974 with the Watergate scandal. So the 60s were an anxious time. It's funny, I was talking with my dad about this recently, and he said, you know, that era of time, it just always felt like the world was going to end. So to give you a few kind of a background on this, here are some of the things that were happening in the 60s. You had several really significant assassinations. You had JFK's, John F. Kennedy's assassination, Martin Luther King Jr.'s, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy. There were also several dictatorships that were taken down or governments that were taken down through assassinations. You also had some huge war and violence that was happening. At this point, this was, you know, about 20 years after World War II, and there was kind of this sense that it was supposed to end all wars, but it really hadn't. It had fractured governments and kind of created all these smaller conflicts that started cropping up. And you also had the movement of communism across both Eastern Europe, where my mom actually ended up working in the 70s, and that's a whole other story, and then in South America and in Asia. So you had that, and a lot of that was accompanied by pretty intense revolution and uprisings and violence. You also had the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was the moment where we kind of feared imminent nuclear destruction. You had the Vietnam War that lasted for 20 years, from 1955 to 1975. We had 58,220 U.S. casualties, and not to mention tons more, actually, in Vietnam, whether that was through the soldiers or also through the civilians. You had communist movements, Cuba, USSR, Vietnam, Laos, China, where there's huge upheaval. You also had huge cultural changes. You had things like civil rights movement, as the population, the African-American population started to lobby for, you know, try to do away with these terribly unjust laws like the Jim Crow laws. And there were, that was a really intense time movement for that. And then that, the Civil Rights Act, I think, was in 1963. You also had things like Woodstock with kind of the free love movement and the rise in the use of drugs. And that was all happening in the 60s. And, you know, I've always thought that those, Joel and I were talking about how those things kind of have to be connected. If you feel like you might be at any moment annihilated by a nuclear bomb, you understand why people kind of gave into this, either into kind of a depressed nihilism or into a hedonism. So the 60s were this time when huge cultural and political change was happening. And then, of course, you had, I didn't talk about this, but you had the Watergate scandal, which led to Richard Nixon's resignment. But you had these huge upheavals, and not just upheavals culturally, you had this kind of sense that at any moment the world could end. And it kind of left people struggling to know how to live and how to live well. And so that kind of translates, I think, into the music that started to be made. I think so often what we see in art, whether that is in music or in novels or in movies, is oftentimes people trying to work out what to make of life, what to make of humanity, who we are as people, and what to make of the world and how we are to live through art. It's trying to reckon with, trying to work through, trying to persuade people to a different opinion, really responding to our time. And that's certainly true of the music that comes out of the 60s and 70s. They are asking the question of, how do we live in times like these? How do we love and live and have children and build something worthwhile in a world that always seems to be falling apart? And when I realized that a lot of the music from this era was asking that question, I realized that it was no wonder that I resonated with that, because I feel like now we are still asking the same questions. We may not have quite the same sense of the world ending like they felt it, but I don't know about you, but the last few years I have felt in numerous moments like, how do you live in times like these? What does it even look like to be loving, to build something worthwhile when you always feel like the ground underneath you is shaky? So you started to see the musicians in this era kind of deal with this, and they do it in different ways. So I'm going to show you a few little kind of like examples of this. You have some people who deal with it in kind of an almost lighthearted way. So I'm going to show you a song from one of my very favorite artists, Joni Mitchell, although I discovered her much later. And this is her famous song, yellow taxi, big yellow taxi. So I'm going to show you just a little clip of that, and we'll talk about how it's responding to that time period.
Took all the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people $1.50 just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Okay, so this is kind of a playful response to the difficulties of the 60s. If you listen to the lyrics, she's saying, we took all the trees and put them in a tree museum and charged the people $1.50 just to see them. And I think what I love about that line is it kind of gets at the feeling of she feels like she's living in this world where they've lost touch with the good and the gentle and the sweet things of life, just like of having trees. It's a very normal, natural thing, to the point that we can't even see them without putting them into a museum that we pay to go see them at. So there's this kind of like we were talking about last week in Barry, there's this disconnect with real life and this feeling that all the things that are natural and good and growing, you're separated from. And so she kind of deals with this in this light way. And then I love the second line where she says, hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT, you know, which is like the really strong chemical they started spraying trees with. Give me spots on my apples or leave it to the birds and the bees. And there's a sense of kind of a longing for a peaceful, almost agrarian time, a time when you were and farms and near family and in this kind of natural sense. And she's saying now we've kind of tried to control everything and we've paved everything. We've paved paradise and put up a parking lot. So that's kind of an example of a kind of more lighthearted treatment of it, while still being a really, I think, revelatory piece about what it felt like to be in the 60s. And in some ways, I think I still feel that way. We're kind of, we still want and long for real life. But now it feels like the thing that's separating us is not the concrete parking lot, although that still is, but kind of the screens and the way we get invested in technology rather than the beauty of the world. But let's get back to that sense of a deeper, kind of more angsty feeling of the unsteadiness of the world. And I think that something that really reveals this well is Scarborough Fair or The Canticle by Simon and Garfunkel. So I'm going to play you a little beginning clip of this. And I think you'll recognize it immediately.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine.
So hopefully that is familiar to a few of you. To me, it is one of the most haunting and beautiful songs. Now you may be wondering, but Joy, what does this have to do with the 60s and with the Vietnam War and with all of these angsty things you're talking about? And to answer that, I need to give you a little bit of a history in the song. Now, Paul Simon, who wrote most of Simon and Garfunkel's, and don't say I said this, but most of my favorite of Simon and Garfunkel's songs, did not actually write all of this. This is based on a traditional folk tune, a British folk tune. It dates at least back to the 17th century, which is the 1600s, but they think far before that. And it also is related to a Scottish folk song called the Elf King or Elf Child. And it is a song that is kind of a story. And in the story, you have this main narrator who's speaking to a third party. And this is the part that we heard where he's telling him about this lost love. And the song goes in these kind of these two modes. So first, he asks his friend, are you going to Scarborough Fair? That's where my love is from. And then he says, tell my love to do these things. And then there are these three things he tells him to do, to tell the love to do. And if the love can accomplish these tasks, he says, then she'll be a true love of mine. So it starts with this, she once was a true love of mine. And then he gives her these tasks. And then it says, then she'll be a true love of mine. So this is the traditional, most of the words, I have this in my blog so you can see compared to the original ballad versus this one. But most of the words are just drawn from that traditional tune and from this very, very old song. Now, the kicker in the song is that the three tasks that the narrator gives to his love are all impossible. So he asks her to knit him a cambric shirt, weave him a cambric shirt, but one that doesn't have any seams. And then he asks her to get him land between the shore and the sea. And of course, there can't be land between the shore and the sea because that's just in the sea. The shore is the sea. And then you also have him saying that she needs to wash the shirt, but not get it wet. So there's this sense that he wants to be with his love, but the tasks that he gives her are impossible. Now, there's two interpretations of this. It could be that he just really doesn't like his old love, and that he doesn't want to be back with her. But I think the actual answer lies more possibly in the time that it was written, in which there were numerous plagues going around. So historians have said that this song, the original, the ballad, was kind of a representation of the loves that were lost to the plague. And there's this sense that even if you could do all these impossible tasks, you could never retrieve your love from the grave. So I hope that you're beginning to see perhaps how this might pertain, the sense of longing for something that they can't quite grasp, longing for a peace, for a stability that isn't there yet. And something else to note about this is that all of the examples, and Paul Simon keeps these in the song, are all these kind of agrarian images. So that means it's something to do with farm and with nature. So that kind of goes back to the playful bit with Joni Mitchell, of the sense of being connected with nature and there being this peacefulness before there's machines and guns and all that. And that becomes important with how Simon then kind of changes the song. So it's, you know, it's something that's weaving and it's a farm and it's the ocean. So now let's look at what Paul Simon does to change the song. Now, if you listen to it, there is this background voice. So while you have the original verses singing, so that is in the verse, it would be on the side of a hill. Wait, where is it? So the second verse would be, tell her to make me a cambric shirt, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, without any seam or needlework. Then she'll be a true love of mine. But while that is going on, there's this other voice that's singing another verse back to it. So I'm going to show you a little clip of that.
Tell her to make me a cambric shirt, a deep forest green, parsley, sage, rosemary, and snowdrops, barren and snow-crested plough, without no seam or needlework, and then grows the child of her mind, and she'll be a true love of mine.
So can you hear that kind of, you have the one voice singing the traditional folk tune, and then another voice kind of weaving in and out behind it, singing these other words that are not in the original. So I'm going to read you what the verse that's singing behind it, and this is what it is. On the side of a hill in the deep forest green, tracing of sparrow on snow-crested brown, blankets and bedclothes, the child of the mountain sleeps unaware of the clarion call. So there's a lot of kind of mystery and imagery tied up in that, but I'm going to give you a little bit of it. And what you need to know as the key to this is that a lot of the words that he invests in these other verses that aren't in the original ballad come from a song that Paul Simon wrote a year before this was done, in 1966. So he did this in 1965 on a song called On the Side of a Hill, which I read at the very beginning of this. And this song has this kind of very disturbing image of a child that's died because of a war, who's on the side of a hill. And so you see that in this, in the way that he articulates, on the side of a hill in the deep forest green, the tracing of sparrow on snow-crested brown. Now, Simon and Garfunkel also has a song called Sparrow, which I think I have on the playlist, so you can listen to it, that's talking about a sparrow kind of wondering to God if God notices if it falls, or, you know, which is based off of the verse that says God sees every fallen sparrow. So that has the sense of the fear and the anxiety. And then the clarion call. A clarion call is a call to war. So basically what you have is has the second verse that's based on this anti-war song that's talking about the difficulties and the being torn apart of war, in conversation with this traditional folk tune that is longing back for union, and it's using all these agrarian images. So on the one side of this verse, you have someone singing for desire to be united with their love, and doing these tasks that are life-building tasks that are agrarian, that are about growing and nature and connection with that, while you have on the other side this voice that's singing the song of a land that's been torn apart by war. So you have this kind of conversation going back and forth. And I think what that is showing, by weaving these two voices together, Simon is asking the question of how do we live a loving and fruitful life in a violent and unsteady time? And so you've got that kind of happening. You've got this voice that's longing to be united with its love, and then the voice that's reckoning with the violence and the ugliness around it. And so you've got one voice that's gentle and loving and planted, and then another voice that's of wars and this kind of forgotten innocence. And this also sense of like, we can't even remember why we're warring anymore, but it just keeps going. That's one of the lines. And the other thing that's interesting about this is that when you think about the idea of the impossible tasks, it feels like for Simon, like living a life of love, of union with the people you love and with the earth, is like the impossible tasks of the lovers. It feels like you want that so dearly, but it feels like an impossible task. And I think that's an incredibly beautiful, but also an incredibly difficult and sad thing that he comes to, is this kind of question of, is it impossible to live a good life in this world full of brokenness and difficulty? And of course, the answer is, in one way, no. When I listen to this song, I think part of the reason I love it is because it puts its finger, I think, on what a lot of us feel, which is we have these inclinations towards goodness and beauty and light and love. We have these inclinations towards wanting there to be justice and peace and mercy. And we really want to live that out. But there's also this sense of fear or of almost hopelessness that is it the impossible task that the lover has given us? Is it something that we cannot accomplish in this world? When we see the voice of the other verse coming through to us. And like I said, I think that it has a real value and that it just puts its finger on a feeling that we have and articulates something that we couldn't necessarily articulate just with words. And I think that the answer to this question of is it an endless battle that is hopeless is, first of all, no. Because even in these difficult times, there are always, as Mr. Rogers would put it, helpers. There are always people that are fighting to still plant the garden, to love, to show mercy, to show kindness. And there are always artists who are grappling with the darkness and trying to push people beyond these kind of black and white, yes and no narratives that lead us towards difficulties and hatreds. But there's a sense in us that we want more than that. We want to say it has to be kind of an almost an overthrow. We have to say there would be a total break of this order that seems to always lead towards destruction. We want a different sort of kingdom. We see all of our own kind of, you know, kingdoms and governments that they always are tending towards war. And we would need a totally different sort of kingdom to fix this sort of impossible task that is set for us. We need something like this. They will not labor in vain, nor will they bear children doomed to misfortune, for they will be a people blessed by God, their descendants with them. Before they call, I, the Lord, will answer. While they are still speaking, I will hear. And the wolf will lie down with a lamb, and they will feed together. And the lion will eat straw like the ox. And the serpent will have dust for food, and they will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain. That is from Isaiah 65, 23-25. I was trying to think of how to end this episode because I didn't just want to end it on that question of, is it an impossible life? And it struck me, this verse came to my head because I have been thinking a lot about the imagination of kingdoms in different literature. I've been listening to The Republic by Plato, and he's building up this incredible kingdom, or not kingdom, a republic rather. I don't know if Plato would hold with the idea of kings. He's building up this republic that in his mind is the philosopher's city that would rule best. And I was struck by the fact that there was a bit of me that I was still unsatisfied, that he builds this whole philosopher's kingdom, but there's still a sense of people who are not going to do well in that kingdom. There'll still be people at the bottom. And I was thinking that to really satisfy the desires of our heart, it would have to be something entirely different. And it came to my mind, these images, these kind of prophetic visions in Isaiah of a totally different sort of world. And that's what Isaiah paints in this picture is, you know, that a wolf and a lamb, usually the wolf be eating the lamb, could lie together and feed together and wouldn't hurt each other. And the idea of the serpent's food being dust, meaning it will no longer eat, it will no longer be a predator. It's this image of a world that's totally turned upside down. And part of this idea is that it's like a different government. It's like a government where God is king, and God's kingdom is merciful and kind and nonviolent. And that is something that's really interestingly played out in the painter Edward Hicks, who I've also put in this in my show notes. You can go look this up. He was a Quaker preacher, and part of being a Quaker is that they are pacifists. And he held to the doctrine of the inner light. Now, Edward Hicks was in 1780 through 1849, so he lived right through kind of the settling of America, and he was with Quakers who were often very abolitionist, and they were trying to kind of solve social ills, and they're very famous for that, and they still are. But he holds the doctrine of the inner light, which was that if you devoted yourself to God and turned your will towards him, you became this kind of agent of redemption. And the Quakers were kind of extreme in the way they lived, and part of that was because they thought that they didn't belong to any earthly kingdom. They belonged to a kingdom that was entirely peaceable. And so in his paintings, in this really interesting and kind of extreme way, he painted 62 versions of this scene in Isaiah, where you have, I've put one of the final ones, where a little girl has her fingers in the hair of a lion, and where you have the wolf and the lamb laying together. And there's this sense of a world that we can't even imagine because it would be so turned on its head. But what I love about this is that Hicks grappled 62 times over and over again as he painted this, and he painted it in lots of different ways and had political messages sometimes, the spiritual messages sometimes, that he really believed that if you were a person who was committed to God, you belonged to a different sort of kingdom than the world. You were a member of the peaceable kingdom. And as you lived, you sowed the seeds of a peace that would bloom eventually. And that as you did that, you could trust that death and violence and ugliness would never have the final word. It was kind of this idea that even if you couldn't see it now, the task of goodness was not impossible. And that didn't mean that the world wasn't still fallen and that difficult things would happen and that your life might even end horribly, but that there was this promise of a total turning upside down of the way the world was, where there would be no harm on the hill. I love that juxtaposition of Simon and Garfunkel's, on the side of a hill that's looking at this war. And then the juxtaposition with that, with Isaiah 65, of there will no longer be any harm or violence on my hill, says the Lord. And that's something that I have thought about a lot, is it's not easy to have a persistent hope in these times. But something that I try to think is that I am an agent of the peaceful kingdom, and that my life can have these little moments of the breaking in of what the world will be like when God is king and God is loving and good and kind. And that is something that gives me hope. And I know that a lot of my listeners share my faith, but I hope that that would encourage and maybe kind of make you think, even if you're not a believer, of what would it mean for you to live like you were a part of the peaceful kingdom, where the ruling nature of it was love and goodness, and there was a hope that was beyond this kind of seeming impossible task that set out for us in Scarborough Fair. So those are my thoughts for you all today, to think about wanting to sow a life and knowing that even when it looks like it's an impossible task, even when you feel like you're doing the impossible task because of the Scarborough's lover, that you're really sowing seeds for the peaceful kingdom, and to never give up hope in that, even as you live in these kind of difficult and trying times. And that when you can't be that deep about it, you really ought to listen to 1960s and 70s music, because it will put its finger on the desires and feelings of your life, and it's absolutely lovely and bopping. So go check out that Spotify playlist, and I'm going to end today playing you a little clip of the song that Joel and I wrote, and I hope that you will go over to the Patreon account and get the download for free. Look forward to talking to you all soon. Over and over into the